There's something about building things, the amount of money that it takes to make a building, the kind of planning that you have to do in advance, and how it affects the people who move through it. You can think of film as a kind of building that's constructed inside the head of the audience, whereas a real building is something that the people physically come into. So it's, film is like an inverted and interior form of architecture.
Questions, folks? Yes, sir.
Well, I wanted to get your response to, or elaboration or clarification about that old story that I've heard many times about about Coppola having anticipated that they would not be receptive, the Paramount management would not be receptive to a longish Godfather, that he cut it it was cut into a much shorter version, and that Evans, appalled, said, give it more length, give it more life. Is that the true story?
Yeah.
Well, excuse me, one second. Did everyone hear the question at the back? Yes. Good. Thank you.
Was the first assembly of Godfather did come in at a little over 3 hours long, and the contract that Francis had signed was for a film not to exceed 2 hours and 20 minutes. And, Francis was trying to do the right thing, and he supervised a cut that was 2 hours and 20 minutes roughly long, showed it to Evans, and Evans, to his eternal credit, said, this is a very bad long trailer for a very good film, put everything back. It eventually wound up being something like 2 hours and 52 minutes or something, so not quite 3 hours, but it is interesting, as I mentioned in the film, that The Godfather was not previewed, I think, of all the films that get made today, and the importance of the preview process, and how important and successful a film Godfather is, and yet it never went through the preview process. So it says something.
And just part two on that was that I remember Francis having said a long time ago that the exhibitors' reactions to Godfather were fairly negative,
yes,
particularly the darkness of it and...
Right. Darkness and length. We had an exhibitors' screening probably about 2 weeks or so before we finally finished it. We were in the middle of the mix, and we did have a screening for the exhibitors. The mood was kind of dark afterwards, because it's 3 hours long, and it is a dark film that ends on a kind of tragic note. I remember that I think Godfather was the first film of that length not to have an intermission. All films in the 1960s that were that long had an intermission. And actually, we had planned where we were going to have an intermission. Was that going to happen? But again, I think it was Francis and Evans also felt, we're not going to let the audience off the hook. This is too compelling a film. We're not going to let them relax in the middle. We're just going to keep their feet to the fire, so to speak. So that was also, from the exhibitor's point of view, a concern, because what is a three-hour film without an intermission? They hadn't heard of that before, and intermissions are a good place where you can sell popcorn. So there was a screening subsequent to that, which where you could kind of feel the engines of the film, commercially speaking, beginning to take off. And we were doing some mixing stage, and Al Ruddy, the producer of the film, came in and walked up to me and said,
"Through the roof, baby."
which it did. It was the highest-grossing film of all time when it came out, in terms of dollars. Quickly exceeded by Jaws, I think, the next year.
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, I
Wanted
to thank you. It was such a wonderful time.
Thank you.
And it's kind of making me think, though, because
in the course of your career at a time pushed out the great craft, the great editors. And now we have the desktop era. And I'm wondering what observations you have in your optimistic or pessimistic about how people will come to know this craft.
Optimistic. I think the question, if you didn't hear it, was I started working back in the days of what Dominic Dunn called surgery without anesthesia. We actually cut the film itself and physically spliced it together. And now, of course, we don't do that. We either don't shoot it on film at all, which is becoming more and more common, or we edit electronically and we only selectively print those sections of the negative, but we don't actually even cut the negative anymore. But the technology of editing, spurred by Final Cut Pro and now Avid, another the more entrenched system, has also followed suit in that you can set up an editing station on a laptop very easily, and on all my films I give assistants and apprentices or anyone who's working on the film who has the interest, I say, well, do you want to cut a scene? And I give them the raw material for a scene, something that I've chosen that I think they can handle, and then they take their laptop, and in between tasks, there's a lot of waiting around, and so instead of waiting around, they can actually cut something together, and then when they're done, we bring the sequence over to my setup, and we can look at it on a larger screen, and I say, well, very good. Why don't you think about this and maybe take a little more time here? And I don't quite understand this moment. And as they go away, recut it, bring it back. I make some observations, take it from them, give them a new scene to work on, and I take their scene and move it into the flow of all of the scenes in the film. So it's becomes much more participatory. And you know, really the only way to learn how to edit is to edit. It's like dancing. You can read about dancing, you can watch people dancing, but you never really learn how to dance until you get out on the floor and learn how to move your body to that particular piece of music, and that's what editing is like. So really for the first time in film history, once the material has been digitized, you can copy it just like copying a word processing file. So you can create a copy of the film very easily, and the station on which you can then cut this film is just a laptop. If the assistant has a laptop and has a copy of Final Cut or Avid Express or something, they can start to work on it, and that's the first time in film history that that's been possible. So on that level, I'm quite optimistic.
Yes, I was present at the first preview screening for Cold Mountain when you came up with the last reel that had been just came from the film printing.
Right.
Could you comment on how the picture looked then? It seemed to be very linear with the final release. The changes that you made as a result of seeing it on the big screen?
You know, I'm trying to think back. Actually, it was mostly pulling things out to make it go faster. I think we previewed the film at 2 hours and 45 minutes. Something like that, and the final film was 20 minutes or so shorter than that. One of the scenes that was a casualty of that process was a scene in a town where the chain gang which involves Inman, Jude Law, and Philip Seymour Hoffman, come into a town. They're sat down, and Philip Seymour Hoffman sees the slave girl that he had tried to kill when we first met him, and she's pregnant with his child now, and she's with some other slaves, and he calls to her. She can't recognize him at first because his hair has been all cut off, and they have a meaningful exchange, and Philip Hoffman decides at that point that he's going to try to escape from the chain gang at the first opportunity because he has a baby on the way. So he's going to actually be responsible and marry somebody of a different color who used to be his slave. And that whole scene got cut out, and the subsequent scene in which Philip Seymour Hoffman, the Beezy character, led the escape with Jude Law, Inman, being a reluctant participant, turned into a scene in which Jude Law led the escape with Philip Seymour Hoffman being a reluctant. So it's those kind of, you know, I was talking there about breaking bones and hoping that you can re-knit them another way. That's a scene I now, you know, with hindsight, I wonder, well, we might have, in the interests of making a film shorter and more more character motivation on the Inman part, maybe that was a scene too far, and that it would have been better had that scene stayed in the movie. I don't know. It's one of those gambles.
Yes, in the far corner.
It was a cold call. Edie was my first assistant on English Patient, and at the time this film was made, she and David were working on Corpse Bride in London, and I had just finished Cold Mountain, and they said, do you mind if we come over and ask you some questions and shoot them, put them on film? And, you know, I said, sure. It was no preparation for it. It was their idea, and we did it over two sessions, I think 3 or 4 months apart or something like that. And then they subsequently added all of the clips, and then about a year later, the material of me working on Jarhead, assembling Jarhead, which I was doing up at Lucasfilm up in Cassia.
Is there a piece of music or composer you listen to when you edit?
No. I the ideal thing is what I was talking about in the film, which is that the composer for the film has written something, and I'm dealing with that material right from the beginning. I think it's unwise to put film and music together too early. They don't quite know what to do with each other yet, and so I cut a scene together without reference to music, and as I was indicating there, without reference to any sound. I turned the sound off, so I'm just cutting the scene together, thinking, does it tell itself as a series of visual shots? You know, I know what the people are saying. I can because I know the material so well. And it's only then that I turn the sound on and I refine the sound. And then perhaps once I've got the scene to a certain state, then I will selectively think, maybe I know this scene is going to have music. If I don't have the luxury of having the work of the composer himself on the film, I will use a temp track. But only after the film, the image itself has become rhythmically mature.
Yes.
No. It's what?
Will this movie affect the way you
edit? I don't know. I mean, contemplative. Maybe I'll start talking like that. To say two things at once, I'll have to take lessons from Edie.
Yes, Jeffrey.
I was wondering if you had any opinions about some of the editing that's been going on with some of the action films. Particularly, I was thinking of the second Bourne film. I think that there's a tipping point where rapid cutting,
right.
You know, that thing you said in the film about you, you know, you don't give people a chance to breathe, you don't let them catch up with it. It starts to drive you crazy in a way. And I was wondering if you had that reaction to any action films.
Yeah, no, I think there is something, and I think it's my. I think there's something fairly deeply encoded in the way we process information that is, it can be manipulated for short periods of time. Obviously, commercials, which have to deliver a whole, or music videos, which have to deliver a whole series of images that will catch the eye in an environment where there's a lot of competition. The commercial doesn't want you to get up and get up here. It wants you to keep you sitting there, and music videos that are played in department stores try to make you look at them. And so directors who come from that environment and come into making feature films think, well, that worked in that environment, I'll just do the same thing here. But it's different because you're in the dark, you have no other distractions. Getting up and leaving the film is really the only choice that you have to make. You have to be there at 8:30 when the film starts. It will start without you. And so the focus of attention is very different. You have the audience here. You don't need to constantly be yanking them about. And I put the emphasis on constantly. There are times when I will do that same kind of thing, but you have to do it and know what you're doing, and not just say that that's a general approach. My rule of thumb for an action scene is that let's say an action scene lasts for 3 minutes, I will try to have no more than 14 setups per minute in those 3 minutes. I don't mean cuts. You can have more than 14 cuts a minute, but a setup is a view of a person or an angle on the action. You know, camera's in a certain position looking at the action, and you can see Matt Damon, and then you see the car coming around the corner, and then you cut back to Matt Damon. Well, you cut back to the same setup for his reaction to the car. But the point is, when you cut back to Matt Damon, the audience has already seen that's already in their head. So when you see that shot for the second time, it's a shot that has a template where it can come to rest. So don't show the audience more than 14 untemplated new pieces of information a minute. Otherwise, you start to get into this area where it's just, you know, it becomes an effect for itself rather than a method of telling the story. You want an action scene to both be comprehensible and clear, but also to, in its assembly, to evoke some of the feeling of what it's like to be in the middle of a car crash or a gunfight or a fistfight or something like that. So there is a lot of confusion and stuff, but obviously you can go too far and make it too confusing, or you can do the other thing, which is not have enough action and then the audience feels something's missing. So my rule of thumb is 14.
And in the back of the...
I appreciate your breadth of vision. There is metaphor you use. And I'm curious what you do or read for intellectual nourishment.
What do I read? Yeah. Two things. We don't have a television at home. We have the ability to run DVDs or tapes, but we don't have broadcast television. Sometimes to the frustration of my wife. we used to, and then we got rid of it in the mid-1980s, and it's I would recommend it. Right now I'm very interested in astronomy, and I read a lot about astronomy, which seems very different than film editing, but they're related in the sense that they're all about finding patterns in phenomena that at first glance seem to be chaotic. The material that a film editor gets in the state that the film editor gets it is not totally chaotic, but it can be overwhelmingly a lot of it, and to find exactly the right shot and find exactly the right shot to go next to that is a process of finding patterns in a welter of material, and astronomy is kind of like that. I also translate from one language to another, from Italian to English, which also I think is very similar. That process is recreational because it's not film editing, but it's very similar to the kind of decisions that you make when you're editing a film, because what we're doing is translating from one language to another. We have the language of the script, which is words on paper, and we're translating from that language into the language of a series of moving images accompanied by a series of sounds in time. And those are two very different things, and the same kind of decisions that a translator has to go through. Translating from Italian into English, you say, well, I can't literally translate because the languages have different efficiencies, and they're better at some things than others. So here the Italian uses three words, but I'll just use one English word. But that throws the line out of kilter, so then I have to compensate later on and add a couple of extra words, but that means I have to break the line here, and then maybe I should just eliminate the whole next line, and so on and so forth. So it's those are the main things.
When you talk about that process, or when you talked earlier about architecture and film, it reminds me a little of when Vaclav Havel asked Frank Zappa to be his Minister of Economics, the economy, I think. And when questioned about it, he said, well, he knows all about composition. So he should be able to put the country together in the right form.
Yeah, well, that's true.
Yes, ma'am.
Do you have an organizing principle when you start a new project, something like a meta principle that you use in your imagination to guide?
Well, I try to discover what that is. Yeah, it's largely a wordless process. It's hard to talk about it, other than to the extent that I talked about it in that scene from The English Patient, and the scene, you know, and the example of Michael of Al Pacino talking about how he discovered the technique for Michael, the thinking of the light shining on him. Subsequent to telling that story, I learned from from Gordy Willis, the cinematographer, that when he saw the kind of makeup that they were using for Marlon Brando, he realized, the only way this makeup is going to work is if I light from above. I can't light from the side or frontally. I have to cast the light down. So his lighting style was determined by the makeup of that Marlon Brando was using. You know, he was 46 at the time of shooting The Godfather, and he was playing somebody in his late 50s, early 60s. And I think Al Pacino saw these lights all coming down, and that gave him an insight into how he was going to do the acting style of Michael. So it's a lot about things mutually influencing each other. And at the beginning of a film, you feel almost hopeless. Every time I think, I can't do this, I don't know how to do it. but I have to start somewhere, so I might as well start here, and this isn't working. And, you know. And then you just keep at it, and somewhere around 2 weeks into the process, you'll do something. Sometimes it's an accident. You'll do something, and it will just call out to you and say, that's what I want. You know, this film wants that kind of thing. And you try to make it true to the film and to emerge out of that film itself rather than be something that you imported from some other film. That's one of the reasons I don't have a television in the house. And when I'm working on a film, it's very difficult for me to look at other films at the same time because my mind gets kind of driven crazy by the, you know, the process of trying to discover what's right for this film, and then I see something else, and I think, well, I'll use that. But then I think, no, that's wrong. I can't do that. And it takes time to find out what it is, and it's. I remember on the conversation, it was a cut from. It was in the scene where Harry was assembling the tape, and it was a cut from the roller, the pinch roller, suddenly coming off of the tape as if he'd pushed a button. So click, it went up in the air, and then cutting to Harry's face, and Harry kind of looking up, he's just realized something. And that combination of that click, click, told me something about the process for that film.
And Richard?
Yeah, I'm wondering if in the Bean Project, if you are able to watch the films you have not worked on, are you able to watch a film just as an ordinary person, or is your editing cat always on, just unconscious?
No, very. I when I watch other films, I really am. You know, it's hard for me to think about them editorially, unless there's really obviously something wrong with the film, and then I have. You know, either I should get up and leave, or I'll sit and watch it like a surgeon would watch for some. You know, I would examine it clinically and say, well, what can I learn? You know, what disease is this film suffering from, and what are the symptoms, and what might I do if it was under my care? But if the film works at all, I mean, if it's from mediocre to good to very good, I just am an ordinary audience. It really takes some kind of very bad something with the film for me to have to switch into editing mode.
I think we have time for a couple more questions.
You mentioned in the film with working with the director, and you come up with an idea, and then the director will come up with an idea, and you'll play off each other. But I imagine there are times when the ideas are in conflict, and I'm wondering how that.
Yeah, a good double-digit percentage of not only being an editor but being any head of a department in film is learning a kind of diplomacy about what you think is right and offering up an idea to the director and being bold enough to do that and persistent enough to a point, and then realize where that point, if you pushed it one more, would become annoying. So my rule of three is say the idea. If it's clear that the director does not like that idea, say okay. And then maybe find 2 days later another way of getting that idea across, and then if that doesn't work, wait a week or so and try it again in another way. And then if it's still no, then drop it. And it may surface later on. You know, you planted the seed. And it may seem like it fell on barren soil, but maybe it'll surface later. And if it doesn't, it doesn't. But at least you've said your piece. And you try not to ever make it get into that kind of a struggle.
Last question.
You didn't really mention too much in your film about deadlines and how they play a role in the film gets abandoned, how oftentimes has the film been taken away from you where you felt like you could have done a whole lot more and it just didn't have enough time?
Good question. No, deadlines are very obviously a huge function of filmmaking because of the economics of it, to a degree that is similar, again, to architecture and dissimilar to more solitary art forms where there isn't as much money at stake, where you can take a little more time. Deadlines can be friendly things because they force you to make a decision and say, well, this is what I can do in the time I have. And frequently you come up with wonderful things that if you had all the time in the world, you never would have done. There's a great quote from Leonard Bernstein. He said, to produce great work, you need two things, a plan and not quite enough time. that's true. Forget the second part of the question.
Have there been any instances where a project has been taken away before you felt that you could actually say, put your stamp of approval?
No, although I was fired off of Return to Oz, the film that I directed after 5 weeks of shooting, and was rehired a couple of days later thanks to the intervention of George Lucas.
Never heard that film.
Who came to my rescue. So that for a while it looked like that was definitely going to be that case. But other than that, no, it hasn't happened.
Well, thank you, Edie and David, for making this wonderful film, and of course, Walter. Thank you.